Hi, everyone. My name's Brian Krause, and I'm very excited and honored to be here tonight to introduce Daniel Paul. To say something about Daniel Paul's work, you have to think about history. History is often presented as an absolute timeline of facts, but we have to remember that history is something put together by people, and often only people on one side of the story. However, luckily, there are some people in the world working tirelessly to bring the sides of the story that we don't usually hear about into the light. Daniel Paul is known by many names in this province, such as Mi'kmaq elder, author, community columnist, progressive visionary, and human rights activist, just to name a few. His parents are from St. John, New Brunswick, His parents were relocated from St. John, New Brunswick, to Indian Brook, Nova Scotia, setting the earliest stages of his life before his birth with a tone of overt racism. After growing up in Nova Scotia and moving to Boston at the age of 14, he then, after several years, came back to Nova Scotia, working in various management and accounting positions until beginning work with the Nova Scotia Department of Indian Affairs in 1971. Over the next 15 years, he held progressively more senior positions in this department, offering advisement and assistance to the bands in the province, offering district management and project implementation at the band level. Finally, in 1981, he began a five-year term as the district superintendent of lands, revenues, trusts, and statutory requirements. However, in 1985, he started on his own endeavors, founding the Confederacy of Mainland Mi'kmaqs and holding the position of executive director for 9 years, until 1994. This confederacy worked to represent all Mi'kmaqs in this land towards the provincial and provincial governments on behalf of the Mi'kmaq band councils and individual band members. Now, I'm going to list some of his accolades, and I'll probably miss a few, but he was the director and president of the Mi'kmaq Native Friendship Center for years. He's a commissioner of the Nova Scotia Human Rights Commission, the member of the Nova Scotia Student Aid Advisory Commission. He's a member of the Order of Canada and the Order of Nova Scotia, the recipient of several honorary degrees, diplomas, the honorary title of district chief of the Shubenacadie Mi'kmaq District. He's been known as a bi-weekly op-ed community columnist in the Chronicle Herald, and he is author of the book We Were Not the Savages, now in its third edition, and it's the only major history text on the colonization of North America written by a First Nation citizen instead of by the European historians. He's fought tirelessly to better the lives of Native American people in this land, and through his writing, his work, not the least of which is this book, which I believe is available tonight, he's telling the side of the story that can't remain untold any longer. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to Daniel Paul.
I don't do much reading when I'm talking, but I'm going to do a bit of reading to start. And silence. It takes a lot of courage to stand up and begin to speak out. And in this country, it's been, I guess, the fairy tale of all times was that what the Europeans found here when they invaded the continent, the Americas, was bloodthirsty, barbarous savages, people who had no civilization and so forth and so on. And if you were to believe what they tell you, gee, they were lining the shores encouraging the Europeans to come invade us and help us because we're all starving to death. Of course, there was around 98 million people residing in the Americas at that point in time, and which was about 40 million more than resided in Europe. Silence is them, it's them, not me. The root of intolerant excesses of Nazi Germany, to make it personal and gain a feeling of what it would be like if you were on the receiving end of intolerant brutality, designations such as the indigenous peoples of the Americas, race, gender, sexual orientation, religion, atheists, and so on, can be substituted with the following. First, they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out, because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. And that's about it. When we're willing to say intolerance is acceptable at any level, in any direction, we are participating in something that is not, positive toward building a great society, a society where everybody is unequal, don't matter who they are. Author Martin Niemöller, born in Leipzig, Germany in 1882, was a German pastor and theologian. At first, he was a supporter of the Nazis. Then, because of their barbarous, intolerant excesses, when they achieved power, he opposed them. For doing so, he was incarcerated at two death camps until 1945, when he was released by the Allies. And that's what he had to say about intolerance. In 1492, when Columbus got lost at sea and accidentally landed in the Americas, his mistake marked the beginning of the most barbarous destruction of robust and viable civilizations that this world has ever seen. From the Arctic Ocean to the tip of South America, no indigenous civilization escaped the terror of European brutality to come. White supremacy beliefs propelled the carnage onward, and there are instances where it is still happening today. Without a doubt, the horrific white supremacy European colonial beliefs, which were responsible for dispossessing the American Indian inhabitants of the Americas of their properties, and far too many cases their lives, was never more clearly articulated by anyone better than the way United States President Martin Van Buren articulated it in 1837. Buren said, "No state can achieve proper culture, civilization, and progress as long as Indians are permitted to remain." Upon return to Spain with American Indian slaves in tow, still believing that he had landed in the Indies, Columbus reported to Queen Isabella the riches he had found in the Indies. I'll just interject at this time that Queen Isabella financed Columbus by seizing the property of Muslims and Jews, and actually she gave the Jewish people a choice. They could convert to Roman Catholic Church, they could leave the country, or could be executed. And that's how that ship was financed. The news spread quickly within a very short time frame under guise of Christian crusades and so-called civilized missions. A full-scale European invasion of the Americas was underway. In reality, a big G was at the forefront of the rationale for the invasion. In fact, it was the prime motivation for it. However, it wasn't the Christian God leading them on to do his work. It was the supreme god of Europe's aristocrats and gentry that motivated them, a European disease called greed. It's a disease that Chief Setting Bull profoundly described in these words. And he said, "Love of possession is a disease with them. They take tithes from the poor and weak to support the rich who rule. They claim this mother of ours, the earth, for their own and fence their neighbors away. If North America had been twice the size of this, there still would not have been enough. The Indian would still have been dispossessed. Over the next five centuries, the barbarous assault that the invaders launched throughout the Americas against American Indian was merciless. During the European colonization process, many American Indian populations were wiped out completely. The remainder, by the destruction of their food supplies and trading patterns, were reduced to states of starvation and malnutrition. Not one indigenous American civilization was left intact. The persecution and denial were so effective that population increases among the survivors were rare until recent time. During the early stages of ethnic cleansing and the quest for European dominance, no tools of mayhem were left unused. For instance, the barbaric torture and degradation methods that were developed by the pre-colonial European leadership, which were used extensively by them over the eons to terrorize their own populations into submissions, was imported by them into the Americas and used against comparatively defenseless American Indian populations. Also, the deadly assault included such things as feeding human flesh to dogs. You don't learn that in school, do you? None of this. Germ warfare. General Amherst, the commander-in-chief of British forces in North America, discussed with his lieutenant how it would be possible to spread smallpox among the Indian tribes of North America. Enslavement, scalp proclamations, and other terrorizing tactics too numerous to mention here. From a Eurocentric point of view, it's understandable that very little of the before mentioned is taught in school. The horrific sense of their heroes of colonial and more recent times are not something to be proud of. Also, without conscience, demonizing propaganda, which depicted the indigenous peoples of the Americas as bloodthirsty, barbarous savages, was created and used by the invaders to dehumanize our people. And you look at the systemic racism that we contend with today, and that's a direct cause from it. And then we have the Doctrine of Discovery, a papal document that stated that non-Christians could not own land, was used to give a smidgen of legality and Christian blessing to the stealing of American Indian national territories, and for the carnage that the invaders visited upon the citizens of lands they illegally appropriated. Therefore, in view of the onslaught that they were facing, it should come as no surprise that the citizens of the American nations who were being butchered, robbed, and dispossessed by the invaders, who were armed to the teeth with lethal weaponry, fought back heroically to preserve their freedom and countries. The twisted result of the before mentioned in view of white supremacist attitudes prevailing should not surprise either, but it does defy logical, rational reasoning. Because the indigenous peoples of the Americas fought the brutal European invaders to preserve the territory and freedoms that the Great Spirit had given them, the resistors were and still are depicted by many as the villains. It's crazy, isn't it? This was our continents, but we're the villains. Thus, when a logical and reasonable person with honesty contemplates the result, she cannot help but conclude that it is incredible in the extreme to find that in the overall scheme of things, the American Indian victims are the villains, while the European bandits are the heroes. Such an outcome makes as much sense as would a murder victim's family being ostracized and victimized because they caused discomfort for the murder. Over the centuries, since 1492, very few Caucasian leaders have acknowledged the bravery and nobility of the Indians who fought and died in efforts to preserve and protect what was theirs. This is what the Honorable Joseph Howe, a former Premier of Nova Scotia and father of Confederation, made this comment about the Mi'kmaq in 1867. And this, by the way, is the only one in all my research that I ever found where a Caucasian had actually said something like this. And Howe said, "The Indians who fought your forefathers were open enemies and had good reason for what they did. They were fighting for their country, which they loved as we have loved it in latter years. It was a wilderness, but it was their home. And what God in his bounty had given them, they defended like brave and true men. They fought the old pioneers of our civilization for 130 years, and during all that time they were true to each other and to their country." And that was the only acknowledgement that I ever ran into of the country actually belonging to us. In more recent times, when out-and-out genocide was no longer tolerated by most international governments, the interlopers turned to more insidious methods to realize eventual extermination. Examples: malnutrition, food rations, third-rate medical services, non-Indian adoptions of our children, Indian residential and Indian day schools, which were created and used doggedly by them to try to brainwash our children into believing that they were descended from inferior savage cultures, most of these assaults fit nicely into the United Nations definition of genocide. American Indian invisibility. This statement: the greatest danger of oppression lies where bias is so pervasive as to be invisible. And that's what it is with us. And I'll explain it a little later on and give you some examples. It was coined by Dalhousie University professor Susan Sherwin. And it concisely identifies the type of racism that American Indians are contending with in modern times. I have a few examples of it here. Systemic racism, racism created by colonial dehumanizing propaganda is alive and well at present. Few examples. This is from the Halifax Herald. 80 indigenous people were massacred in Venezuela by Brazilian gold miners in July of this year. It wasn't reported, but a National Geographic reported it at the end of August, and one world newspaper had a little paragraph about it, and that was a Swedish newspaper. Was nothing reported in Canada, United States, or anywhere else. It was simply 80 people massacred. And it was greed. People, gold miners, they're the ones that done it. Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka. I imagine everybody in this room knows who they are or heard something about them. Well, at the same time these two people were being tried, John Martin Crawford, who had murdered four Cree women, tortured them, raped them, was on trial, and not a word in the press. Little paragraph in the back of the paper. And Paul Bernardo and Carla were making headlines, television, everything. They killed a couple of white people, which is a horrendous crime, make no mistake about it. But when John Martin Crawford was sentenced, the judge told him, "You know exactly what you did, and you know what you were doing. You picked out these women, and you murdered them, raped them, tortured them, because you knew full well society wouldn't care, and society didn't care." John Martin Crawford is an open incarceration out in a prison in British Columbia. He has free run of the prison. He's not punished in any particular way. Paul Bernardo sits in isolation. He's allowed out of his cell once a day. And why is there such a difference here, okay? Because some of the people were people of color and the other were Caucasians. That's the only way you can handle it out. Newspaper columnists are continuously expressing their expertise about subjects that they know absolutely nothing about. First Nations finances. I've yet to read where one of them has asked this question: why didn't the funding organization, Indian Affairs, which controlled the purse strings, not demand and hold out for transparency and accountability at the band level? Is it easier to blame the Indian than to point the finger at where it rightly belongs, at Indian Affairs, an organization controlled by white men, and ask them for accountability? Not one. I've read columns in Globe and Mail and Winnipeg Free Press, the Halifax Herald, you name it, and not one of them has asked the government of Canada, how come you permit it? What's going on at, no accountability, transparency at the band level? And why not? We had two royal commissions now. We had one way back in the 1990s, and it had no subpoena power. It couldn't interview witnesses under oath, and they spent $50 million on it. I was very, very supportive of that commission when they struck it up. I was executive director at the time of the Confederacy of Mainland Mi'kmaq, and I was really looking forward to it. I thought they were going to cross the country and they were going to subpoenaing director generals of Indian Affairs and all the rest, former employees, and questioning them to find out, you know, how come there wasn't perhaps banned constitutions put in the 1960s when they were being the send the funds out to the bands and what have you. And maybe talk about such things as scalp proclamations in Nova Scotia, the fact that the Beothuks in Newfoundland were exterminated, and things like this. I thought, gee, this is really going to be something that, you know, is really going to put history on the table. And then nothing, really. It came out with a big, thick report that I put on a shelf when I received it and never looked at it since. And then we have another one today on residential schools. And it has the same problem. It's no subpoena power. They can't interview witnesses under oath. And it just, why? Any other Royal Commission, look at Junior Marshall here in the 1980s, 70s. When Junior, they struck a Royal Commission here in Nova Scotia and they gave it full subpoena powers and all the rest. And that one was very productive. It wound up in reforming the entire justice system in Nova Scotia because it pointed out its shortcomings. Judges were appointed because of political patronage right up until that point in time. And one of the worst statements ever made by a Supreme Court judge was one that I can't remember his name offhand, but when he told Junior Marshall, you were the architect of your own misfortune. Well, I beg to differ. There was a black kid and a red kid involved in that fiasco in that park, and a white man. The white man was a wino, and not much good, you know, for promoting society, the best things in society. However, he was the one that killed Sandy Seals. And it was more or less known by the authorities at that point in time that they had a very, very weak case against Junior Marshall, but they proceeded with it, convicted him, and the only thing I can ever say about that conviction was that he was convicted of murder because he was a Mi'kmaq. And if Junior had survived and Sandy Seal had died, I think you would have seen the same thing. Sandy Seal would have went to prison, wrongly convicted, and maybe one day released. I don't know if he would have been, because Junior had a supporter in his father that wouldn't say die. Donald Marshall, Grand Chief Donald Marshall Sr., he fought tooth and nail until he got his son out of prison and never left a stone unturned to get it done. But I don't know if Sandy Seal would have had that kind of support. But that's racism, okay? Right up until that point, you don't see it happening in Nova Scotia. At one time, right up until that point, if you were from an African Nova Scotian community or a Mi'kmaq community, you were, quite possible that you would wind up in jail for nothing. Because any time a crime was committed, where did they look? They went to the nearest black community or nearest Mi'kmaq community to find the culprits. 9 times out of 10, they would discover that the culprits were among their own. I'm only 74 this year, and when I was born in 1938, we had no rights whatsoever. Legally speaking, we were considered equal with drunks and insane people. That's to say, legal rights we had. We were wards of the crown. And on and on and on. We weren't allowed to go in a liquor store. We couldn't hire a lawyer to take on our legal cases. All this was legislation under the Indian Act. But now, I'm going to go back a bit. And let's have a look at Europe 500 years ago. They came looking for barbarism. I can't see why they ever did. My God Almighty, the Europeans were terrorized into submission from the time they were young until they, most of them never escaped it. They owed their life to the country store, I guess, or the lord of the manor. Newfoundland was the same way right up until 1948 when it became part of Canada. people were, from the time they were young, they got into debt with the people they worked for, and they stayed in debt until the day they died. And when you look at the things that Europeans did to one another, you know, I can't recall finding anything in the Americas where, prior to Columbus, some of the civilizations used to burn people at the stake. I really can't find that. Drawn and quartering, that was no, I've never heard of. How about the rack? And on and on and on. There was no poorhouses in the Americas. There was no bedlams for the insane people. The elders were well looked after in our community, Mi'kmaq community. Elders and children were well looked after. They were respected. There was no such thing as poor houses. Everybody shared equally. And I'm going to tell you something that not too many of you know. Prior to the European invasion, the Mi'kmaq probably had one of the highest standards of living in the world. There was no hunger among the people. Food was plentiful. The ocean was bountiful. As a matter of fact, it was so bountiful after John Cabot came here in 1497 and landed off of Newfoundland and discovered the fishing grounds there. Within 5 years, it became so active with European fishermen that the Portuguese began to tax it. It's just something that greed is a terrible thing. It has no place in society unless it's well controlled. In Mi'kmaq society, there was no such thing as greed. Everything was shared and shared equally. After all, you couldn't make a canoe, and you wanted a canoe, and you could fish, and you could hunt, and you could bring things into the community. When I was researching We Were Not the Savages, some of the things really floored me. Yeah, some of these missionaries would be discussing the civility of the Mi'kmaq and then wonder in their writings, how could these savages be more civilized than we? And that's actually statements that they've made in the records. I've encountered quite a few things from the missionaries, and some of it was quite funny in that regard. I remember, I have it in my book actually, We Were Not the Savages. Divorce was a thing among the Mi'kmaq. You could get a divorce, and a missionary was trying to convince this Mi'kmaq man, but there was something wrong with divorce. Nobody should be allowed to divorce. And his response, and I can't, he says, "Dost thou have no sense? She hates me, I hate her, I like her, she likes him. We all go our separate ways. We're all happy. Why should we stay and hate one another?" And that's in part of the history, okay? Things like that. And that is, I could, you know, it frustrates me to no end to know that history is being, I guess, how would you say it? I've been accused, okay? I'm not recognizing the fact that the Spanish, the British, the English, the French, and Portuguese, and so on and so forth, had good reason for what they did in the Americas. They did. They weren't under attack. They were attacking the civilizations that were well established. They were taking everything these people owned. So what's the reason? If I'm out there and I'm stealing your car, discovering it, I should say. I'll discover your car. And you come out and you beat me half to death. And then you're prosecuted for doing so. You know, it don't make sense, okay? But what it leads to is simply this. It's white supremacist thinking. And how do we overcome it? It's going to be a most difficult thing. Because the title of my book is We Were Not the Savages. If we were not, then who were? And you badly treat your own people. The first legal execution in what's now Canada occurred in Montreal, I think it was 1867. 1667, somewhere around that. And it was a young girl. And you know what her horrible crime was? She stole something. And she was executed for it. Executions in Europe were widespread. They were for lots of things that, you know, is unbelievable today. But I really not here to get too deeply in Europe. I don't really... I got a couple of Halifax Herald things here. In 1535, French explorer Jacques Cartier discovered the Miguel Islands between Anacostia Island and Quebec mainland. He did? Gee. I don't know what the hell them Indians were that were there. I guess they weren't people, but, you know, they occupied the place a long time before Jacques Cartier got there. But he discovered it. And this is where we become invisible. My wife and I went out to Colorado, out to Denver, went to the Rocky Mountains and down to the Grand Canyon and caravans and caves in New Mexico. And at one of them, I can't recall which one, I think it was in New Mexico, we saw a sign. Yeah, I believe it was. It was the caves, the caravan. Caverns. The sign said this. It was discovered, I believe, in 1847 by so-and-so, a Caucasian. And then it went on to say, but the Indians were using it a long time before that. So what does that say? It says the Indians weren't people, okay? Mm-hmm. And at one time, I'll be quite honest with you, the black people of Africa and the red people of the Americas were classified as two things. The black man was described as a work animal, and the indigenous people of the Americas were described as wild animals and treated as such. Charles Saunders, who ran the Dartmouth Daily News, I guess he was the editor over there, when I first published the first issue of We Were Not the Savages, he wrote me a note, and he said he attended a thing at one time, a presentation, where the Mi'kmaq individual got up and said, we were lower than slaves. And Charles said, I wondered how could anyone possibly be lower than a slave? And the fact is, the slaves had value, okay? You could sell a slave. The Mi'kmaq were wild animals, not only the Mi'kmaq, but other indigenous people, and they were slaughtered indiscriminately. And Manifest Destiny, which the United States has about something that legalized their terrorism across the continent, where they wiped out entire populations and what have you. All this is something that we have to begin to learn. In the Americas in 1492, there was civilizations that ranged from city dwellers to hunter-gatherers, such as the Mi'kmaq, farmers, great corn patches. There was a great deal of things going on. There's a great book here, 1491, by Charles C. Mann. Some of it kind of gives you a chuckle. He did a lot of research, and conquistadors were walking down the streets of one of these cities, and it's got a mile-long name. I can't pronounce it. I tried. But as they were walking down, they were looking around like a bunch of country yokels going to New York City or something, because they were astounded. Here was a city that was sparkling clean, had running water, had sewers that were working. In comparison, at that point in time, if you went to London, Paris, Madrid, Rome, what have you, you were to go to a city that had open sewers. Disease was rampant, and poverty was just as rampant as disease. This is a great book in the sense that it goes on and it identifies a lot of things. How many of you had cornflakes today? Good. American Indians invented corn 10,000 years ago. Horticulturists, American Indian horticulturists. And at that point in time, if you do European history, you'll find that most people there were living in caves. And that is something that is not taught in school, and why not? When you go to university, you're taught Greek history, you're taught old Egyptian and so forth and so on, but why not American? Okay, Native North and South America. Why not the history of these two places? You go to Central America, you find great temples from the Inca and Maya and so forth and so on. These were great cities, left behind great cultures. The Maya are still 10 million strong in Mexico, and I got a kick out of it because they hate the word Mayan. Okay, there's no such thing. I went into a shop in Cancun one time, my wife and I, in 1993, I think it was, and I was bartering with this young guy who owned it about a blanket, and it was quite funny. His grandmother was sitting there, and she must have been in her 80s or 90s, and I said, well, we're down here to do the Mayan coast, and she says, Maya, Maya, Maya. And I said, yes, you're right. I said, because when I think about it, there's no such thing as Micmacin anyway either. Okay. So it's really... another thing is, I sent out a memo today and yesterday, and some of you may have read it, but it really is a question like this. How many of you know the name of the guy who claims he discovered America, the Americas? You all do, don't you? Yeah, Christopher Columbus. What was the name of the people he met?
Arawak.
Pardon me?
Arawak. Oh, sorry, the Arawak.
He met the Taino. That's who he was. Okay, and why shouldn't you know that? Okay. The reason, because they would have to begin to talk about the civilization that was destroyed. And when you talk about Christopher Columbus, he wrote to one of his friends and said, young girls between 8 and 10 years old are in big demand among the slave traders when you're out collecting them, look for these. Okay. Some say that the Taino were somewhere around 5 million strong when Columbus first landed there. Within 50 years, they were, for all intents and purposes, they were extinct. And they were the people who the Spaniards often used to feed their dogs with. When you're looking at a little closer to home, there's a book called Roger Sutton by Thomas H. Riddell. And while I was writing We Were Not the Savages, I was attacked right, left, and backwards, you name it, by a lot of people. And one guy came up to me and he says, your ancestors were headhunters. They went out, hunting heads. And I, what in the hell are you talking about? Something I, never heard something like that before. And he said, well, the great Thomas H. Riddell said you did. And I didn't know what he was talking about. So one day I was down at the waterfront, and a friend of mine owns the bookstore at Historic Properties, and said, Danny, I want you to take that book home and read it, called Roger Sutton. And I did. And I was outraged. Actually, it's owned by Dalhousie University. And I think Dalhousie should put on the front of it very sensitive racist material included. Because he does state in his book that the Mi'kmaq collected heads. Now, I don't know why a warrior would go out and maybe, might have killed 10, 15 British soldiers in one day. Why would lug around 15 heads? Because you can search this province far and wide, and New Brunswick and PEI and the Gaspé, the rest of our territory, and I can guarantee you will not find a shrunken head. So they didn't do that. So what did they do? It's ridiculous, but it's in there. And the Acadians in this book get a bad rap too, to be honest with you. They're ignorant... barbarian savages who are controlled by the missionaries and have no mind of their own. I have another one here that I just want to, the Halifax Herald. Oh, it was 1767. England held its last burning at the stake. You know, those little tidbits, okay? And why is it so difficult to talk about our civilizations as if they had no value? Because once you begin to do it, then you have to go a little further. You have to begin to understand that Europe was a very violent society. That prior to going abroad, the Europeans practiced barbarism against one another. France and England, for instance, had a war that lasted 100 years. The people that started it and the middle ones, and toward the end, they would have all been dead, and maybe nobody knew what the hell it was all about. But they were so engrossed in killing one another that they invented more and more lethal weaponry. And when they took that abroad to places like the Americas, where, you know, bows and arrows were lances and a few things like that were all they had, and Africa were the same thing, and when you look in Australia, the same thing again, these people were defenseless. But I often think there's one thing I wish had happened to Columbus, that he had went up shore a little further and landed in Cherokee country. I don't know if we'd be having this discussion tonight. The color of the room might be entirely different. It's simple. The Taino were a pacifist people that really had no way to defend themselves. And all of a sudden they were face to face with brutality that they couldn't comprehend and they couldn't figure out how to do. Here's a book, it's called Distant Relations, and it's by Victoria Freeman. And Victoria was told by, she's a very educated woman, she has a couple of PhDs, doctoral things, so certificates. And she was told by her grandfather and uncles and father and so forth and so on, what wonderful people her ancestors were. They came to the Americas and they worked hard and they did this and that and they were saintly and so forth and so on. Gee, Victoria said, they were so great, I better take a couple of years off of teaching and do some research and write a book. By the time Victoria got finished, she was so traumatized by what she found out that I don't know if she ever really got over it. She discovered that one of her ancestors was responsible for the death of 800 women and children and old men in a fort in what's now Connecticut that was burned to the ground, and as they were trying to escape, they were all executed. She must also discovered that the three chiefs that were invited to a meeting and by a certain individual to talk peace, they were murdered as they walked into the room, and he was also a relative of hers. She also discovered, and this is a very interesting book, and it's called Hidden History of Massachusetts, and it's a controversial black bestseller. And this one talks about the slavery in the Americas. The merchandise in the first slave markets in the Americas were not Africans. They were American Indians. And when you're looking at the Puritans that went into what became Massachusetts, they were starving to death. And the tribes there took them under their wings, helped them to survive. And 20 years later, the chief that led that act of generosity found that his two sons were sold into slavery by the same people that he had helped survive. This is something that's all part of the history, and it's documented. My book, I started off, We Were Not the Savages, and I simply state in it, in the front page, this is not my history, this is yours. You go to the back, you'll find the references. You go over here to the archives, you'll find it all. When you're looking at Nova Scotia, the French came here in 1504, and individuals left behind got along quite well with the Mi'kmaq. And this disproves this notion about the Mi'kmaq and other tribes being barbarous savages. These people got along, they intermarried, and they eventually became the Acadians. And they lived among the Mi'kmaq for 160 years without one drop of blood being spilled. Well, if Mi'kmaq were such savages, how did these people ever do it? And the reason they did it was because they respected the Mi'kmaq. And they wanted to use land, they went and asked for permission. And the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713, when Great Britain took over what was then Nova Scotia, which included New Brunswick, under that treaty, the Mi'kmaq and all their lands were treated, transferred by France to Great Britain. And the Mi'kmaq never knew, right up until that point in time and beyond, that France had claimed their territory. They never went out and told the Mi'kmaq that we own your land. And this is over 100 years. And the way they found out, the Mi'kmaq was in 1715. There was a few skirmishes between the British and the Mi'kmaq. And there was a meeting between some Mi'kmaq chiefs and British officers. And at that meeting, the Mi'kmaq were informed by the British that they were now the subjects of the King of England, that all their land belonged to England, and that they would have to pay homage to that king and eventually have to agree to assimilation with white settlements set up among themselves. Of course, the Mi'kmaq rejected it, and they traveled up to Louisburg in Cape Breton to find out what was going on. And that governor, and I have this in my book, he told them at that time that the English were lying, that the French never did claim Nova Scotia as their own. The gentry, the aristocrats and what have you were lying. The people themselves, and this is quite unusual because I go travel around Nova Scotia, and I was in Matagan one day and in a restaurant, and I got the biggest kick out of it because I was listening to several Acadians talking in French. And I heard several Mi'kmaq words, and one I heard that really turned me was Mudwess, which means porcupine. And I went over and I told him, I said, you guys are talking, you know, using some Mi'kmaq words. And no, that's French. And I said, well, Mudwess is Mi'kmaq. And he said, it is. And I said, yeah, really. And things like that is something that could have happened here in Nova Scotia. It didn't. It could have happened in New England. Populations were completely wiped out. But there was one god that kept them going, and that was greed. And I'm not saying that it was, you know, the average Joe and Jane and these civilizations that were doing this. It was, in fact, the gentry, the aristocrats, and what have you. I suppose the soldiers at that time had poor choices to make if they didn't go out and do the dirty work of the leadership, then they probably were executed. So they, one way or the other, they weren't going to survive. But that's all part of our history, my friends. And what we got to do is begin to talk the truth. Here's a book, An Unsettled Conquest, and it's by Geoffrey Plank. And I, at that time, I was writing, when this was published, I was writing a column for the Halifax Herald. So I told Geoffrey, I said, your book isn't going to be reviewed by the Halifax Herald. And he says, why not? And I said, because you tell the truth in it. Okay. And it was quite funny because he came to Nova Scotia. He was teaching a history professor at the University of Cincinnati, and he called me up in Truro, and he asked me if he could meet with me. And I said, sure. And we made arrangements to have lunch here in Halifax, and for a half hour or so, and that lunch lasted 4.5 hours, I think. And I challenged him. I told him, I said, take off your rose-colored glasses and write a history book that really talks about what went on in Nova Scotia. And he did. To his credit, he did. So I did a review, but it was rejected because, you know, I was told, you creature, you, how dare you be so disrespectful of my sainted ancestors by a few people. And I'm not disrespectful of anybody, to tell you the truth, because history is history. We can't change it, but I'll tell you one thing. We can begin to correct the wrongs of history and begin to look at how to put it together in a proper manner where people are taught from early childhood until adulthood how history transpired. You go to England and really learn how the English people lived way back 500 years ago. And then you can understand that not only the English, but the French and the Italians and so forth and so on, the common peasants. And you can understand why there was a mass escape from Europe. It was not a very nice place to live. And why don't they teach that in school? And Queen Elizabeth I, gee, she rose to top leadership. In that time, women weren't even allowed to blow their nose without getting permission of the lord of the manor. She was totally brutal. She lopped off the head of her sister when she got in the way. So, you know, when you're looking at history, you got to look at it with open eyes and begin to look. When I'm here's an interesting book, okay, and it's Massacre of Glencoe. And it kind of gives you a preview. It's 1692 and it happened in Scotland. When the King of England and a couple of his advisors decided maybe the best way to terrorize the Highland Scots into submission, the Jacobites, would be to massacre one clan. And so they picked out the MacDonald clan and they sent in, I believe, 800 soldiers to live among them for a week or so. And they seemed like they were friendly and everything. And then one night at midnight, all of a sudden, the people heard the soldiers marching and they began to slaughter the Clan MacDonald. And it was labeled a barbarism by the House of Commons, but nobody was ever punished. And the reason for it was the King of England was involved, and who could touch him? But that's a very interesting book itself. And here's the tribe that's never talked about, as you're going, the Beatoks of Newfoundland, who were totally wiped out. And I believe 1827, the last of them were slaughtered. And at that point in time, they refused to have any truck with the Europeans whatsoever. And it can be understandable when you look at 1497, after Cabot and influx of fishermen from Europe. These people were brutalized from day one. Many of them were sold into slavery, and they viewed the Caucasians as being barbarians, so they refused to make peace with them. And I think the tribe actually decided that it would be better to be extinct than be part and parcel of a society where Europeans dominated. There's great things that happened in Europe, you know, great inventions, things like that. But for all we know, there may have been cancer cure here in the Americas. But when you go and you look at what some of the missionaries did in burning all the documents that related to the medicine of the Inca, the Maya, and so forth and so on, these people were very advanced in science. The Maya had a calendar. I got a calendar home that they used. I believe it was based on a 50-year cycle and was accurate to 5 seconds or 10 seconds, something like that. I'm not sure what. But and some of these the pyramids that they built were built in such a manner that precisely once a year light would shine through a certain area. And that's how they adjusted their calendars. The first suspension bridges were not in Europe. They were here in the Americas. And I could go on and on and on. And what I'm really trying to get across to people when I give these kind of things is systemic racism. When I was young, you went to a movie. One weekend, it would be cowboys and Indians. And you would see the Indians slaughtering these saintly European settlers that were trying to head out west. Or you would see an African one where cannibals were hunting down, you know, some Europeans off, and you would see them in pots and being cooked and so forth and so on. And when you're looking at this kind of thing as a child, it instills in you a very high degree of lack of confidence. And I had, in my lifetime, when I ran away from home and went to Boston when I was 14, I was about as, beat down as you could possibly get. Very few of you went to school and were taught in school that you came from an inferior civilization, that you had to give up all your rights and everything else if you ever wanted to succeed, and accept the right way, and so forth and so on. In history books, and when I went to school, there was a half a paragraph, and it stated that the Mi'kmaq made axe handles and baskets, and that was it. The nuns were very crazy about religion, I should say, that if you didn't pass catechism, you never passed anything. You could make 100 in math and English and so forth and so on. And all this is part and parcel of what the problem is today. It's how do you get beyond the old books that were written, the movies that were made, the engine giver and so forth and so forth and so on, all these things. The Mi'kmaq people shared equally. And I remember doing some research in this, and they didn't accept that a human could own land. It belonged to the Great Spirit. And two of them sold 1,000 acres to two white men. And they thought the white men were crazy, buying something that they couldn't buy, okay, because of their culture. Said, no, you can't buy that. And when you're looking at the clash of cultures, really, what was the gain by being brutal? Nothing. Depopulating the land, what was to be gained? Nothing. When they could have made peace with the people and probably had a great relationship, a very productive relationship. They were wiping out, I believe it was Colonel Shivington, who made a statement to the effect that every hunter that went out and killed a buffalo was assuring that the Indians would be completely wiped out from the plains, and on, all this. I'm going to open the floor for questioning. If you want to have a few questions, you got to keep in mind I'm kind of deaf. And if you want to ask a question, you have to speak up. I have a little booklet here with some of the pictures I took while I was in Cancun, and it's some of the temples that you want to see down there, and it's really something. It's awe-inspiring when you go. But I'm really, in modern times, we are fighting an uphill battle. I've been at it for a long time. I want the story out. I want children taught from day one, grade primary. It's mandatory in the state of Maine at this point in time. It's a law, actually. I think it was passed around 8 years ago, where history of the indigenous people of Maine has to be taught from grade primary to grade 12. In Montana, the constitution of that state has been amended to force the teaching of history of the real history of the indigenous people of Montana in schools in that state. There's some progress being made here in Nova Scotia. There is some talk about scalp proclamations. How many of you know in 1744 the Mi'kmaq had the fort at Annapolis Royal surrounded under siege? And Governor Paul Mascarene sent the Governor William Shirley of the Mass Bay Colony, Massachusetts, requesting assistance. And Governor Shirley responded by sending in, declaring war against the Mi'kmaq, and sending in Captain John Gorham and his Rangers in to enforce his declaration. And under that declaration of war, he offered 10 pounds per scalp, men, women, and children. And that is a barbarous thing. I don't care how anybody looks at it. In 1749, Great England decided the Lords of Trade, who were the policymakers of the English government, decided that they wanted to set up a settlement in here in Nova Scotia, and they recruited a couple of thousand suitable Protestant settlers and sent them along with Edward Cornwallis to found Halifax, what became Halifax. And Cornwallis sent out some officers to meet with the Mi'kmaq chiefs and informed them that they had to show loyalty to the King of England and accept the fact that the King of England owned all their territory, and the Mi'kmaq rejected it out of hand. And on September 23rd, I believe it was, 1749, they renewed their declaration of war against Great Britain. And in response, on October 1st, and don't go off this so-called massacre over in Dartmouth, whether that happened or not, I couldn't tell you, but it had nothing to do with what Cornwallis did, because the Mi'kmaq had captured the fort at Canso, the British fort at Canso, and taken all the soldiers there and turned them into the French at Louisbourg. And in response, on October 1st, out in what's now Halifax Harbor, the Council of Military Government met, and Edward Cornwallis and company decided that the only way that they could properly settle Nova Scotia, Peninsula Nova Scotia, was to cleanse the peninsula of all the Mi'kmaq. And at that meeting, they decided that they would place a bounty on the heads of the Mi'kmaq people and $10 per scalp. That, my friends, resulted in Captain John Gorham and Gorham's Rangers and two other militias marauding around the province collecting scalps. At one instance up in what's Truro, around that area at this point in time, the fort there, 25 scalps were brought in at one instance. And at first the paymaster refused to pay because some of the scalps appeared to be Caucasian. But the commander of the fort ordered him to do so, and he did. In 1750, maybe the scalps weren't coming in fast enough, but they had another meeting in June of that year, and they upped the bounty to 50 pounds per scalp. In 1752, Edward Cornwallis was taken out of here, resigned his commission, and was replaced by Governor Hobson. And a treaty was signed between him and John Bettis Cope, the district chief of the Shubenacadie area. And under that treaty, there was a provision made that Cope would go out and try to persuade all the other chiefs to come in and sign similar treaties. And under that treaty, there was a provision that should there be any outrage against the Mi'kmaq, they would be prosecuted in English courts. They would be subject to English justice. So a boat sank off of Musquodoboit Harbor, and the Mi'kmaq rescued two sailors from that ship and took them to their wigwam and nursed them back to health. And the four males, one day went out hunting. They told the men that they would return them to Halifax when time permitted, and went out hunting. They left a woman and two children alone with these two men, and while they were gone, the men murdered the woman and two children, and when the men returned, murdered them and scalped them and brought their scalps into Halifax to collect the bounty. That's in 1753. And the Mi'kmaq, of course, become quite upset because these men brought the scalps into Halifax, and they walked away scot-free. They weren't prosecuted. And at that point in time, if British authorities had saw fit to punish these two men for what they did, there would have been peace in Nova Scotia. Okay, there wouldn't have been any more war. That would have been the end of it. But they didn't. And to be quite honest with you, it wasn't a crime in North America to kill an Indian person until maybe the late 1800s and 1900s. Many of our people were killed and murdered and raped and so forth and so on, and nothing was ever done. these are things that have to be looked at. When you're looking at Captain John Gorham, and I threw a fit about this, between Bedford and Sackville, they was a connector highway built, and they called it Captain John Gorham Boulevard. And I, of course, got a little upset about that, and I took them on about it. And even the Halifax Herald, in this instance, wrote an editorial about it and said, you know, naming a highway after a bounty hunter, maybe you're going a little too far. So to rename the highway, but why should we have to do such things, okay? And when you're invisible, the highway going by Annapolis Royal, the new highway when it was first built, they put up a sign and said, Annapolis Royal, Canada's first settlement. Needless to say, I became a little upset when I seen that and heard about it, and I contacted the warden of Annapolis County and the mayor of Annapolis, and I took them to task. And to their credit, they were appalled by what they'd done. And they invited me down, and they had a joint meeting of councils, and they got up and they apologized for it. And then they said, why? Why would we do something like that? And I said, it's systemic racism. Okay, you're brought up with that idea that the Mi'kmaq were not people, you know, or not worth to be considered. And it happened more often than not. But I'll give you a chore to do. I talked about Edward Cornwallis, and you live in Halifax, some of you are being educated in Halifax. There's a park down in front of the old Nova Scotian Hotel, the train station, and it's called Cornwallis Park. Go in there and you'll find a statue of him. And tell me why, if this is a non-racist society, why is that statue there? Okay? It shouldn't be. The man tried to do something. The man tried to do something that is totally immoral. When you decide to wipe out a race of people, you have no defense. You could convict him in a court. He wrote to the Lords of Trade in England and told them what he had done. They didn't seem to have much conscience about it. They wrote back and told him, cautioned them that by displaying our cruelty, you might entice all the tribes of the Americas to come together and expel all the Europeans. But the morality didn't seem to bother them much of what he was doing. And a firm here in Halifax, a beauty parlor, sent three models over that statue with human hair and got their pictures, and it was publicized, and I took them on about it, and one of the models was quite taken aback by it, and she said, if that man did something so horrible, why is that statue there? And it comes back to one thing. Systemic racism. Racism. There's no other question about it. And with that, I'll open the floor to questions. And like I say, if you got any, speak up loud, because I'm deaf and I'll have to say, wow. Yes, dear?
I don't have a question so much as more of a comment, in that you said that it was of no consequence to murder a First Nations person until the 1890s.
Yeah.
And yet we have a national registry of missing and murdered women in Canada, close to 600 and some Sisters in Spirit, and those women's murders and missing have never been solved. So it still seems that it's okay and of no consequence to...
It really, in that instance, it's not... the investigations were very poor and what have you, and again, I think the judge made a good comment in the case of the women that were murdered by John Martin Crawford, and that was, you know, society don't care. And okay, way back.
You talk about greed, you talk about systemic racism, and I agree that, you know, this ethos of individualism with social responsibility is systemic within our society. It's so systemic. It really, it's even in our English language. So, like, is giving a talk of awareness enough? What's the next step? Like, what are the rituals that we, as white privileged people, from a suggestion from you maybe, could partake in on a daily basis to deconstruct this ethos of, you know, stab your brother in the back, you know, to a more collective or part of the land ethos.
I'll tell you a little story. It takes courage, and you begin to speak up. Okay, you begin to write to your MLAs, MPs, and put the pressure on, what have you. It's not easy to do. In Nova Scotia, to find that the Human Rights Act was not put in place until 1967, in 1967 the Mi'kmaq were not included in that act. We were not included until 1991. And Don Cameron, the most conservative premier that Nova Scotia had for a hell of a long time, was the man that had the courage to do it. And he called me up one time, way back in 1990, and he told me, he says, "Dan, I'm thinking of amending the Human Rights Act to include the Mi'kmaq and sexual orientation." And I said, "Yes." I said, "That's a good idea." you know, it's discrimination. Don't matter how you look at it. And he said, "I'm going to do it, but I wonder what the backlash is going to do." And I said, "Well, I'll put it this way, Don. Is the NDP going to take you to task? You know, they're always shooting off their mouth about how progressive they are and human rights and so forth. Are the Liberals going to do it? No. They're the same, you know, in the same boat." So I said, "You represent the conservative element in this province, and if you do it, who's going to attack you? Nobody." And he did it, and no, there was no backlash, none whatsoever. And it took me 25 years to have Cornwallis Junior High, the name of that school, changed. And the people involved in that were well aware of the history of that man. And but you got some very influential people that are, Bob Harvey, for instance, who was a long-term counselor for Sackville. Him and his committee are the ones that recommended that that highway be named Captain John Gorham Boulevard. I went out and met with the man, and I told him, "Do you know the history of Captain John Gorham?" And, "Oh, yeah." And I said, "Do you know that he enforced a bounty for men, women, and children?" "Yeah." And I said, "Don't you see anything wrong with it?" "No." "You said it was war." And I said, "Well, what about Nazi Germany? When the, you know, the Jews and the Roma and what have you were slaughtered there. Do you see anything wrong with that?" "Oh, yes, a horrible crime." And I said, "Why is it horrible? If it's not horrible in the other instance, why is that one horrible in your mind?" And I said, "I'll tell you why. Because the Jews of Europe had intermarried so often with Europeans that they were, for all intents and purposes, white people. And what you were talking about was white people there being slaughtered. And in our instance, it was people of color. And that don't count." You know, that man was so confident of his racism, or whatever you want to call it, that he actually agreed to go with me on CBC Radio on a national program. He was given 15 minutes to defend his position. I was given 15 minutes for mine. And then people from across the country called in for the next half hour, and they castigated Bob Harvey across the board for his opinion, but the man never moved one inch. He still believed what he did was right. Okay, so you're looking at some white supremacist that you can't move, don't matter what you do.
I'm very glad you mentioned Cornwallis, because from the beginning until near the end, it really wasn't mentioned. In Cornwallis Park on November 17th, will be an anti-war rally against the NATO war conference that's happening across in the Westin Hotel, the old Nova Scotia Hotel. That park, this is the fourth year for this anti-war rally, this NATO conference. That park, from the first rally, we covered up Cornwallis's statue with shields.
Bring it down.
And renamed it, yes, and renamed it Halifax Peace and Freedom Park. And we consider our action in that so minor, so meager, compared to the whole campaign to de-Cornwallisize Nova Scotia. to change the history books in that. So there have been victories, like with the school, et cetera, and I want to salute you in the hard work you've been doing on this front to bring the history belongs to those who win the wars. And we have to win this war so that the history is our history, rather than the history of the explorer. So on behalf of the organizing committee of the November rally, the No Harbor for War, I'd like you to warmly invite you to attend, to speak briefly, etc. There on the significance of that statue and of Cornwallis and of we are renaming it as Halifax Peace and Freedom Park. But anyway, the 85 or so people that are here tonight, I did a rough head count. If each and every one can talk to your neighbor, your partner, your spouse, your boyfriend, girlfriend, the kid down the street, etc., about what you heard and learned here tonight, it would greatly assist this man. Thank you.